Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of the Tape to Tape podcast, powered by the new Ram 1500 Sport, built exclusively for Canadians. I'm Ryan Dixon. This is Rory Boylan. And this is a very unique podcast where we're not talking about the news of the day or the week. We're talking about the events of the decade today, counting them down. Mm-hmm. Top 10 hockey moments of the 2010s. Now, before we go any further, let's explain our incredibly unscientific logic. This is going to be a grab bag. We've got all kinds of things here. Things that were important to the NHL. Things that were important to hockey fans. We've got international events. We've even got a few personal items on the list.
Yes.
Things that colored our own hockey lives that we felt like we had to get on this list or involved in this discussion.
My list will not be like yours.
Okay.
And people will see some of mine and be like, what the heck? Because they're personal.
Hey, you know what? There's all kinds of things out there that are far more official than this. So why don't we just go ahead and have fun? Here's how we'll do it. If something appears, we'll count down from 10. If something comes up that's on both of our lists, as long as it's not the first or second thing on the other guy's list, we'll just talk about it when it initially pops up. So kick us off. The number 10 Boylan moment of the past decade.
Okay, this is one of those personal ones. It's 2016. My brother got Leaf tickets through work, I believe it was, when the Florida Panthers were coming through town, my number one team. And it wasn't just because it was the Panthers. It was because the Panthers had Jaromir Jagr. And never in my life did I ever think the Panthers would get Jaromir Jagr on their team and then to be able to see him live. So they were pretty good seats in the lower bowl. I've been to, obviously, NHL games in the past, and as a fan, you see it differently.
Incredible what he's done. Let me take you back to 1995-96. He was a member of what the NHL knew as the Great Line. Mario Lemieux, Jaromir Jagr, and Ron Francis. Pittsburgh Penguins.
Here's the announcement.
NHL history with 1,888. Number 68, Jaromir Jagr.
Gentlemen, we have just witnessed history here, and with a ceremonial gold stick of Jaromir Jagr's authentic hockey stick to signify this moment in NHL history, second spot all time in points in the National Hockey League, Jaromir Jagr.
Well, I thought I was going to score a goal or make a beautiful assist, but hit my ass, so I'm not. I thought it's going to be a little bit prettier, but I appreciated everything. It's me. I played with so many great players during my hockey career, starting in Pittsburgh and even right now with Florida Panthers and Boston. Great players. Thank you very much, guys. And, you know, thanks for the fans.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Jaromir Jagr.
But seeing Jagr in that way up close in my team's colors was something special. I know it was the end of his career and everything like that, but the way he controlled the game, getting the puck, he wasn't a fast mover by any stretch of the imagination, but he would get the puck and either kind of glide or stop and then just kind of pivot around and get the puck to his streaking line mate, and he scored a goal. The Panthers won the game 4-1. It was fantastic night all around.
It was definitely one of the stories of the decade, having him come back from the KHL and still be a good player and feel like it just added this whole other layer to his story.
And it was actually led to one of the best gifts I think I've ever got too, is that my wife purchased a Florida Panthers jersey. And I believe the connection was her cousin works with somebody who's related to Brian Campbell, who was playing for the Chicago Blackhawks at that time. And was able to get the jersey through this family member to Brian, who had it until Jagr came through Chicago and got him to sign it then, because they had shared a team together in the past. And then that jersey made it back to me, and now I have a signed Jaromir Jagr Florida Panthers jersey.
Well, this could not have been a more brilliant segue to my number 10, the Chicago Blackhawks winning the 2010 Stanley Cup. I feel like it was a case where if you weren't a Philadelphia Flyers fan, you were probably rooting for the Blackhawks, a team that had been really scraped the bottom, the decade prior, and an iconic franchise derided for being behind the times so much when Bill Wirtz was running the team and you couldn't watch the games on cable, but it was so fun to watch this team rise back up. It's the very rare team that actually took the path fans dream of, in that drafted Taves, drafted Kane, almost made the playoffs and made the conference final. And the fans are probably like, well, next year we'll win it. And then the next year they won it. And Brian Campbell was on that team, assisted on Patty Kane's overtime goal. And he's from my hometown of Strathroy. And it was pretty trippy seeing a guy I went to high school with for a couple of years and played against in minor hockey.
Weird.
Carrying the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
I mean, and obviously the way it went down with Kane celebrating like he scored and everyone else looking at each other going, what just happened here? Yeah. You know?
He stopped it. Where's the puck? It came loose on the other side. It's over. Patrick Kane has scored the goal. The Chicago Blackhawks' long drought is over. For the first time since 1961, the Chicago Blackhawks have won the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, this is number 7 on my list.
All right.
I think it had to have been the most anticlimactic overtime Stanley Cup winning goal because no one knew it.
No one knew what happened.
Except for Patrick Kane.
All right, what do you got for number 9?
Number 9, very, very recent, but I think this is going to hold up because it's a first and a second in the NHL. Andrei Svechnikov's lacrosse style goals.
I like it.
You know, they're very, very recent here, but again, like, this is NHL history. And when he did the first one against Calgary, you know, guys had tried it before in the NHL and no one had been successful at it, but he did it and it was like, oh my God, somebody actually did this. And then, well, other guys are going to try it more and maybe we'll see a few more of these. There have been a few more attempts since then, but then the second lacrosse style goal in the NHL was also Andrei Svechnikov. And this one was a little bit quicker, I thought. You know, he went down behind the net. Adam Lowry just got tripped, so there was a little bit of space and he went down behind and I don't even know if he came to a complete stop. He definitely slowed down and then just kind of picked it up and put it in behind Connor Hellebuck.
Knocking on the door, Svechnikov out of the corner. And back of the goal, lacrosse move! He scores! He did it again! Andrei Svechnikov! His second lacrosse-style goal! Put it in the bank! Carolina with a 3-2 lead!
Wow! The lacrosse move is now officially international. He did it against the Calgary Flames, a Canadian team at home, but now it's cross customs. It has gotten through immigration.
So maybe we're going to see a goal every month like this from Andrei Svechnikov, but I'm curious who the second player is going to be to attempt this and be successful at it.
Is the 2010 gold medal game between Team USA and Team Canada at the Vancouver Olympics on your list?
That's my number 2.
That's your number 2. All right, we'll save it then. Give me your number 8.
Auston Matthews.
Here's Matthews with Nylander. 2-on-1. Back to Matthews. He scores! Auston Matthews! 4 goals! Do you believe this?
Do you have this one on your list?
I have speed of Leafs rebuild, number 8. Oh,
okay, well, I have specifically his first game in the NHL.
Okay. Well, these dovetails, so let's talk about them.
Yeah. It was a 4-goal game. Yeah. At that point, I was working the nights here at Sportsnet. And I can just remember the first goal. Like, oh, my God. He scored a goal in his first game. That's fantastic. And then the second one happens. Like, I wonder how many times a guy has scored 2 goals in his first game. And then the third one happens. Like, has anybody ever scored a hat trick in their first game? And we're kind of, what can we do with this? And blah, blah. And then, bang, there's 4 goals for Auston Matthews in his first game, and you're thinking, what the heck have the Leafs got here?
The speed with which the Leafs rebuild came together, I still feel like we overlook sometimes how quickly this thing that, I mean, if you're even our age, I don't want to tack years onto your life, but like the notion that the Leafs are bad, sad, and forlorn was just something is just in your blood. Like, yes. I mean, as you get older and into media and analytically minded, and you realize, well, just because they stunk forever doesn't mean, you know, what happened in 79 doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what happens now. Just the very concept that really good things could happen to the Leafs was just not something that you really contemplated.
Yeah.
And boy, oh boy, did that thing ever come together fast. And obviously they're still trying to get to the next stage or two. That night I was in Buffalo. I was doing a story on Jack Eichel and the Rising Sabres.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Eichel, you may recall, it was obviously it was the start of the year. It was, I think, his last practice before the season. I was just sitting with the other scribes in the mostly empty arena, heard an enormous scream. Everyone went quiet. It was the guy I was there to write about, Jack Eichel, high ankle sprain during his just a random drill, right? I just talked to Tim Murray, who was the GM at the time, about how important Eichel was. And it was one of those eerie feelings where you're like, that's not good. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't good. He ended up missing a bunch of time, and Buffalo's still trying to figure it out, though he's clearly got it together. That night I was in a bar in Buffalo and just having a couple, and the guy beside me I ended up in a conversation with, which can always kind of go two ways when you're a lone guy at the bar, and he was a great guy, and we were kind of just watching this thing unfold, and then my phone started blowing up, and at 4 I was like, oh my God, I got to start texting people, like, this is ridiculous. So yeah, that was definitely quite a night. All right. That was both our eights for us, for who's falling around.
Yeah, okay. My number 7 was the Blackhawks Cup.
Okay.
So we can skip over to you and go 7.
We've already talked about it. Well, again, we're going to sync up here a bit. I got game 7 of the West Final between the two teams of the first half of the decade, the LA Kings and the Chicago Blackhawks. A game 7 going to overtime between two heavyweights. Obviously, Chicago ended up winning 10, 13, and 15, mm-hmm. the Kings, and boy, that it isn't on my list, but the way they stormed to that cup in 2012 as the 8 seed, they win in 12. Alec Martinez wins the game in Chicago on the road for the Kings.
Stole in on Kruger with a bump. Williams in for the puck, feeds it out to Martinez. Martinez with a shot, tipped, score! Kings win the game! Alec Martinez with a shot from the blue line! The Kings are going to the Stanley Cup Final! Remarkable! Incredible! Unbelievable! The Kings have won Game 7 in overtime! 5-4! They are going to the Stanley Cup Final! And they go there by winning 3 Game 7s on the road!
And they go on to beat the Rangers in a sneaky close cup final in 14 that had some overtimes, and the Rangers were probably in it more than the 5 games would indicate. But those were the two heavyweights, man. They were true, true heavyweights, and they really slugged it out. And that was a great series and a great game.
Yeah, fantastic. And, you know, just in that vein, like there are so many of those LA San Jose series that I loved watching, and none of them made my top 10 list here, but I'm glad you called out that was a phenomenal series as well, and the way it ended and everything too. So it's amazing how much times have changed when you look at where LA
really
Chicago
is.
Are right now.
It really is. All right. Number 6.
Okay. Number 6. My number 6 is from 2013. Thomas Hertl was a rookie. He scored 4 goals in 1 game, and it was a blowout win against the New York Rangers. The Rangers weren't happy. Lundqvist wasn't happy, especially with the way Hertl celebrated after the 4th goal.
Here's Hertl again. Oh, does it? He scores again, and what a goal! Wow! Are you kidding me?
And why it's memorable to me is not really because of the goal and the performance by Hertl, but because of Joe Thornton's comments afterwards when he was talking about the guy celebrating in a blowout, scoring his 4th goal. Can't repeat it on this show, but, you know, he would celebrate in a
graphic
way. It was very, very graphic.
Very specific.
And the whole hockey world has been waiting ever since then for Joe Thornton to have a 4-goal game to see what he does.
Gotta keep playing,
Joe.
Hasn't
happened.
Gotta keep playing. All right, my number 6 is another Olympic moment. Wow, the 2014 women's final in Sochi was absolutely nuts. And as listeners may recall, and obviously a little Team Canada bias coming in here, I didn't pick the 2018 tournament when Team USA won. But yeah, Team USA out by a goal in the dying minutes. The female linesman bumped into Canadian defender at the blue line, kind of created a little opening to clear the puck. Down it goes, clanks off the post. And who else but Marie-Philippe Poulin ends up tying the game that could have been done 2-2. They go to a crazy 3-on-3 overtime where there's breakaways and penalties and it's just insane. And Marie-Philippe Poulin, who had two goals in 2010 in the gold medal game, scores the game winner. It was just a, like, on the edge of your seat, bite your nails down thriller.
That's one of those moments. It didn't make my top 10, but I remember exactly where I was. I was still at the Hockey News at that time, and basically we're all around the TV just watching this thing, and it wasn't just our department. It was some people from the other magazines coming around, and everybody was watching this, cheering on Team Canada, and oh my God, when that puck hit the post, that was crazy. What a moment. Yeah.
Doink.
And then to come around and tie it, like just an amazing, amazing game. You know, the women's game in terms of getting more competitions got some way to go, but when Canada and the U.S. play, man,
it really is. Kudos to both those teams for all the entertainment they've given us this decade. All right, that is numbers 10 through 6 coming up. After a little break, we're going to count it down 5-1. Be ready. I'm coming in with a couple personal ones at 5-4. Stick around on Tape to Tape. We are counting down our top 10 moments of the 2010s. We've got some personal stuff in here. We've got some international stuff. Rory's sitting around waiting to see if Joe Thornton will make good on his promise, the promise we can't repeat. Should he ever bag 4 goals before he decides to hang him up? All right, Rory, we're down to the nitty-gritty, the real stuff here. What is number 5 on your list?
My number 5 comes from 2018. So there's not a lot of players anymore who were drafted when I was still in high school. So when they leave the game, especially the great ones, it's extra notable to me. So it was the second last game of Vancouver season 2017-18, their last home game of the Sedin era.
Yeah.
And it was an overtime win against the Arizona Coyotes. OT winner scored by Daniel Sedin, assisted by Henrik Sedin, of course. But Daniel scored twice that game. He scored earlier in the second period as well. And it being the last game, the fact that that goal, the one in the second period, was his 22nd of the season, scored 33 seconds into the period, 22 and 33, the numbers of the two guys. I mean, it couldn't have been any better for a home finish.
Henrik winds away from pressure, carries it through center himself. He's in on the right wing. Henrik with a nice move off the wall, into the slot for Edler. Backdoor Daniel, and they score! And you just knew they had a little bit of magic left in them, didn't you? Henrik to Edler to Daniel. And listen to this place.
They did play a road game on the Saturday night for their official last game in the NHL. That was a shootout loss against the Oilers. I remember I was doing the Hockey Central Saturday radio show while that was going on, and so we were just focused on that. I want to go back and double check how much ice time they got in that overtime, but it felt like they got almost the entire 5 minutes. They're just trying to force them to, you got to score this goal too, this game winner now, and everything like that. It didn't work out quite so well, but the way it ended at home in Vancouver couldn't have been any better.
I mean, the freaky twin stuff that just comes up with those guys is, whether it's the numbers, obviously the intuition on the ice.
Yep.
Wow.
And you know what? Like, thinking back to that draft year again, like I can remember reading the Hockey News' future watch and seeing those guys, and the knocks on them that year being that they were too slight, too easy to push over and everything like that. I mean, only 3 guys scored 650 or more points from that draft class, and number 1 and number 2 are the Sedins, and Henrik Zetterberg was just shy of 1,000. Seventh round pick. So, I mean, it couldn't have worked out any better for them.
2010. I was 30 years old in 2010. I had lived my adult life without seeing the Montreal Canadiens, the team of my youth, win more than one playoff round in a single spring. Won the Stanley Cup when I was but a wee buck, 13, when I was in grade 8. That was a lifetime ago, even from 2010. So to see them sneak into the playoffs as the 8 seed and have Jaro Halak just go other level, upsetting the Caps in the first round, that was one thing. Mm-hmm. Then they drew the Pittsburgh Penguins, which at that time were the defending Stanley Cup champions, not the Penguins that we were saying, hey, is this team ever going to win again? That was the Penguins team where we were like, yeah, well, they're just going to win again and destroy Montreal. And what a break for Pittsburgh that they're playing these guys. Mm-hmm. And the Canadiens were down 3-2 in the series, ended up winning game 6 at home. I don't know if it was a go-ahead goal or an insurance goal, but I remember Yaroslav Spacek, who was very indicative of the rest of the team. Like, he was a little rickety, man. And sometimes you watch Jaro play and you thought maybe you could skate better than he did. But he slammed one home to put it to game 7. And, you know, suffice it to say, didn't really feel good about their odds on the road in a game 7 in Pittsburgh. Just kind of happy to be there. But they came out and stomped them. I think they got a 5-0 in that game. And I was still like, I don't know. Yeah. But they hung on. And, of course, ended up getting destroyed by Philly in conference final, but that was a big one just as a fan to see them actually win a couple rounds and the excitement that came out of Halak mania, and then see him get traded for some guy we'd never heard of about 2 weeks after that.
Yeah, I remember there was the talk at that time, like, which goalie did you
get? Yeah, totally.
Halak, or is it Carey Price? I think they made the right call.
They made the right call, though. Halak certainly did well.
Yeah.
All right, what's your number four?
All right, number four. I have no specific stats or a game score for this or anything like that because it wasn't about those things. So when Connor McDavid came to the NHL, he obviously came with tremendous credentials and everything like that. And I had seen him play on the TV in junior before. But you don't really know how that's going to translate to the NHL until it actually happens. But I can remember the first time seeing Connor McDavid in the NHL and just being like, whoa, this is different. Even when you first saw Sidney Crosby, it did take him a little bit of time, but he was a different kind of player. He stood out and he was fantastic and everything like that, but he didn't look as different as Connor McDavid did. Like, how much faster he was than everybody else, and just then what he could do with the puck while going at that speed. I just remember thinking, like, oh God, I'm seeing the future. I'm seeing some otherworldly talent here that I've never seen before. It's different. And obviously the way his career has gone has kind of kept him on that track. He got injured about halfway through that rookie season that derailed it a bit. But I just will never forget the first time seeing him go down the ice with the puck and just thinking, for all the years I've been watching hockey, I've never seen this.
I saw his second game in the NHL. His first one was at St. Louis. The next one was at Nashville. And I remember I went down to do a preseason feature on Seth Jones and the loaded Nashville D, which included Shea Weber at the time. And I went down early in the week. And when we realized Edmonton was coming in on the Saturday, we just said, stick around and see McDavid's second game and write about that. Mm-hmm. And I just, I couldn't echo everything you just said loud enough. Just, he didn't score in his first two games, he scored in his third game, but just seeing live the way he moved and the way defense had to back off, that's it. You just knew you were seeing something very, very different. All right, my number four. Well, this is very appropriate to bring up because my beer league team, which was our beer league team at the start of the decade, bookended the 10 years with championships. We won in 2010.
Yep.
Win today, you walk together forever. Life took people in different directions. You were one of the guys who, you know, went out the door, and guys are coming in and out, and there's kind of a core group that sticks together through, you know, all these years. But we couldn't win again. It was getting pretty bleak there. It was getting pretty dark. But in our last crack in the winter season, we play winter and summer of 2019, damned if we didn't climb that mountain again. And boy, I tell you. So we won, you know, it's like when a rookie comes into the NHL and wins the Stanley Cup in their first year or first couple years even. You're just like, oh, this is great. This is how it works, right? That's how I felt in 2010. I was still a wide-eyed guy, only 30 years old. Now I've hit 40 and I'm like, God, the world just can really weigh you down. You got to take your victories where you can get them. And man, winning that championship, It's pretty damn fun.
I still have my trophy from the 2010 team on the computer at home.
The big one that they gave the team, mm-hmm. because no one else would take it probably, is still sitting on the toolbox in my basement. So, all right.
Nice.
Number three.
My number three is the 2011 Boston Bruins Stanley Cup Championship.
A leather lung fan, and they have a few in Boston, yelled, "We didn't lose to the British, and we're not going to lose to British Columbia." Hansen gave it across with 15 to go. Despite that adversity, they followed their coach to the high road. And the high road is the road to the cup. No icing. For the first time in 39 years, the Boston Bruins have won the Stanley Cup. And they pour on to celebrate with Tim Thomas, their heroic goaltender.
Now, I'm not a Bruins fan, but my family is, and it had been quite a long time since their last Stanley Cup, and so when they won it and Chara lifted the trophy, I'll never forget calling Dad, and just he was just over the moon. You know, all the crap he would have taken from the last time they won the Stanley Cup from all his Montreal Canadiens fans, family members, and friends, and now Boston reigns supreme. You know, they had been good many times before, but talking to him after the win, after winning a Stanley Cup, like I can remember back being a kid and seeing, I don't know why Glenn Wesley's name stands out to me, but watching regular season Boston Hartford games because Dad had to get Nesson when we had a satellite dish because he had to keep in touch with that team, and you know that goes away and everything, but to just have those very early memories and then to be able to talk to them after they finally won the Stanley Cup and broke their run of futility was really something.
2011 final, definitely have to spend a moment on that one. Sorry, Canucks fans. I mean, the Bruins were really heavy underdogs, lost the first two games of that series in Vancouver, but really outplayed Vancouver. I remember doing the old THN puck panels and saying the Bruins deserve a better fate here, but now they're screwed. They got to win 4-5. There was no chance it was going to happen. I know everyone's dealing with injuries in the Bruins. I guess it was 13 when Patrice Bergeron was playing on half a lung, so you're not going to get any sympathy there. But I will say in the Canucks' defense, as I recall, Ryan Kessler, who was just a beast at that point, playing on an absolutely shredded groin, could play the what-if game forever for Vancouver fans, and I'm sure, and players, obviously, and I have to believe when Kevin Bieksa and Roberto Luongo and Alex Burrows and the Sedins get together, they're like, God, it was right there for us. But full marks to the Bruins. They stomped them in the games they won in Boston and then finally were able to win that. The games they lost in Vancouver, 1, 2, and 5 were super close and at least one went to overtime. But I have to say, as from the Canadians angle, you mentioned all the Habs fans. What I remember from 2011 was my buddy and beer league goalie and fellow Habs fan, Ted Cooper, back in a different phase of life, used to watch about 80% of the games at my apartment on Spadina. We called it the Spadina Sports Bar. And we were watching first round, game 7, Bruins-Habs in Boston. And to my recollection, he was on one couch with a blanket pulled up to his nose, and I was on the other one with a blanket pulled up. And PK Subban tied the game with probably less than 3 minutes to go. It's like, wouldn't even have to look it up. It was a one-timer on a power play. And Tim Thomas made an awkward, it kind of handcuffed him.
Under 90 to go power play. 2 minutes as of now to go in regulation. Laid back, Subban, score! PK Subban with a rocket inside the crossbar. And it's a tie game.
And he acknowledges the crowd, putting his arms up, saying, "Where are the boos there?" What a wicked shot from the rookie PK Subban. What a shot. He got everything on this. The Montreal Canadiens gained the zone, pull up.
And it went to overtime. And your poor old dad would still be suffering if they could have squeezed one more. Anyways, Nathan Horton scored and they won the cup. I don't know if I've told you this. This is actually really funny because your brother is on my beer league team. And he did get the Bruins gene. So he let's just say his life view doesn't align with mine or Teddy the goalies. And I watched that game at a buddy's house, Vancouver, Boston. I was subwaying home. I was one stop from home. Who gets on the subway in a Bruins jersey but Kyle Boylan? And he was like, could this night get any better? I can't believe this. Like, what are the odds, man? What are the odds?
The universe brought you together.
Yeah, it really did. All right. We are down to my number three. I better double check the date. I think it was June 29th, but it was right before July 1, 2016. Speaking of Subban, it was the 23 minutes that shook hockey.
Yes.
PK Subban for Shea Weber, Taylor Hall for Adam Larson, and Steven Stamkos isn't going to become a Leaf. It was like the last thing that happened with the Leafs where you're like, no, you can't win. You can't win. Because at that point, everyone in the world thought he was going to come, and it was literally on Twitter just flames shooting up as I remember it was 23 minutes because Elliot Friedman ended up doing a big read for us. That was like the 23 minutes that shook hockey to its foundation, but two as big a one for ones as you could imagine, especially Subban for Weber.
Yeah.
You know, being dialed into the Canadians world, people just lost their minds. And, you know, anyone who listens to this pod and all my endless fake trades knows how much I love a big deal, even a small deal. And it was just crazy that that was happening. I remember Friedman tweeting, I think he tweeted basically, I think Weber's going for Subban here. Mm-hmm. I was like, this can't be real. It just felt like it couldn't be real.
The three things happened so close together. I mean, it was frantic on the news desk.
Oh my God, I couldn't imagine.
You know, I like looking at those trades now because the Subban-Weber one specifically because, I mean, it was hammered for the most part from Montreal's angle, not because of what they were getting then, but what was going to happen down the line. And we're down the line now.
It's not aging too bad.
Like, we're talking today about Shea Weber being in the Norris Trophy conversation and PK Subban struggling. He was on a huge point streak at the time of this record.
Scoring the goals.
He was not scoring anything, not doing anything in New Jersey. Injury problems and all that stuff. And he's getting close to UFA. So what's going to happen there? And Montreal is chugging along with Shea Weber and looking fantastic. The Edmonton trade is never going to look good. And it's looking worse today that Arizona now has Taylor Hall in the same division as Edmonton.
Do you know, I never even thought about it. I was going to make a joke that I guess Edmonton won the trade after all. They still got Larson.
I mean, you're fighting for a playoff spot. Can you imagine if we get an Arizona-Edmonton playoff series? And like Taylor Hall scores a series winner or something like that, it'd be the worst trade that was ever made in the history of the game. And the Stamkos thing, like,
did you think he was coming here?
No. I mean, because at that point, it was everybody's coming here. Everybody thinks everybody's always coming here. So it was one of those, it has to happen before I believe it. I did think he would go to July 1, though. Yeah. But you did have that negotiating window, so it made sense. That was less of a shocker than the trade tour. Yeah.
Is Tampa going to win a cup with that guy? With all those guys?
Oh, boy. You'd have to think so, right? They're still young enough.
It feels like
it. It's just like you just keep putting that back out there, and eventually it's going to win a Stanley Cup. And a lot of those guys are just starting contracts, right? Or fairly early on in the many ways, the key players in it. So if you figure eventually they're going to figure it out. Yes, I would think they would.
So my number two, we know your number two is the Olympics. So why don't we'll do my number two. Okay. The Jets return to Winnipeg, 2011.
Thank you, Mark. Welcome everyone this morning. And it is nice to be back in Winnipeg after all these years.
Okay. Oh yeah.
What a huge,
fantastic
day right before we broke for the holidays. We rolled out a series of moments of the decade for each Canadian team. Mm-hmm. And obviously the Jets didn't exist in 2010, right? Yep. So the moment was the team coming back. So when I was writing that and just kind of reading some stories about, you know, you forget that the mayor and Thomas Dean were doing a conga line on Portage in Maine. And not that the league hadn't really shifted, the economics had really shifted after the 2005-2006 lockout. Or 2004-2005 and came back. And I remember then, the day St. Louis traded Pronger to Edmonton, I was like, whoa, this is a new world. You know, we had both still grown up and really probably come of age as hockey fans at a time where Canadian teams struggled. And if someone was moving, it was out of Canada to a warm spot. And to have one come back to Winnipeg, to know what it meant to those people, it was just a just a heartwarming, awesome moment.
It always felt like a pipe dream.
It really did.
That they would ever come back.
It really did.
I remember seeing the newscast that day, the people celebrating in Winnipeg. I used to, long before that, though, playing those NHL video games with a buddy, and we would always play as Winnipeg, because just wishing Winnipeg's got to come back.
Someday.
And if I get my hand on a Winnipeg jersey, you would take the opportunity to do that, thinking it would be awesome if they could come back, but it's never going to happen.
I have a vague recollection of you in a Jets jersey on a THN puck panel.
There was an event. I think it was maybe All-Star.
It was All-Star.
And
we all got
the jerseys.
Yeah.
We all got to pick one. So there you go. Winnipeg.
All right. Number two, big moment for a lot of people listening, I'm sure, certainly north of the 49th. So the reason I don't have this higher is because I have to say my Canadian Olympic men's team moment was 2002. That was the one where my life felt like it was on the line.
Yep.
And by 2010, had been working in media a little bit, a little more objectivity had crept in there.
Yep.
And it was a real eye-opener for me, because if I had been my former younger self in 2010, I probably would have vomited the second Zach Parise tied the game with whatever it was, 30 seconds left. And I actually remember thinking, watching it actually at the Hockey News offices, kind of rubbing my hands together and being like, oh, wow, we got a game now. This is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have Sidney Crosby, who didn't have a great tournament, of course, wind up factoring into the winning goal. And as U.S. people will tell you, after a puck hit the linesman's skate and carry him to him, Ryan Suter's clearing attempt, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, a Ginla to Sidney Crosby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just felt like on home ice, not that Crosby wasn't already a huge deal at that point, but that was it for like, well, Crosby could retire tomorrow. And he's going in the Hall of Fame, and he's in the pantheon of all-timers.
He had done everything. That was right. When
Cup,
the moment
Hart
he had
Trophy,
done everything.
Olympic gold-winning goal in overtime at home.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that for me, the 2002 moment was the bigger one. I mean, I remember seeing it with my dad and my grandfather. And, you know,
Hadn't won for 50 years.
52 was the last time they won gold, all that stuff. I mean, just think Lemieux and Sakic, and like, there's just some incredible players. Not that there weren't in 2010, but it's from my childhood,
you connect
with them a little differently. The 2010 one ranks so highly for me because those whole Olympics were so special.
It was.
Like, I still remember the opening ceremonies, watching them on the CBC, and the moment that Canada came in, the music drops, and you just see it kind of on the horizon, it comes up, and it gave me goosebumps. And so many moments from those Olympics, whose name is escaping me right now, the skeleton racer who finished gold,
Montgomery?
And he's chugging the beer as he's going through. Like, there are so many things like that. And then for it to finish the last day, the last event on Sidney Crosby's stick against Team USA on Ryan Miller, I wonder why I wasn't in the office. Maybe you guys were putting in a magazine or something. I watched it at home.
It was like, who can do it? And I was like, yeah, sure, that's fine. I can come.
Yeah.
Like, you know, half of us came in or just a handful of us came in.
Yeah, but I watched it at home, and it was such a huge moment. There was nobody on the streets driving, and you could just hear everybody explode after, like, everybody was kind of similar to when the Raptors won the championship, actually, this last summer, where it happened, and then I could hear everybody in the tower I'm in, and the towers next door, everybody's just going crazy, making noise, and it was the same thing, and maybe on a different level when Crosby scored the 2010 winner.
It was a big one. So is number one. It's got to be a big one. I wonder if we have the same one. I don't know.
No,
we'll
don't.
See. We don't? Okay.
No, mine's personal.
All right. Then you give it to us.
In 2011, I had the chance. I went to Russia for 2 weeks. Pavel Datsyuk was hosting a camp for, he does this every year, it's for kids between the ages of 9 and 12. And so 1 week is for the 9 and 10 year olds, week two is 11 and 12. And I was invited over there by a scout at the time. And it was him and his brother and some people who were helping him out run the coaches and people like that, run the drills and run the 2 weeks for these kids. And it was really, It's my number one moment for a few reasons. Like, number one, to be able to see Russia. And it was the city was Yekaterinburg, but Datsyuk's hometown. So it wasn't one of the big cities. It was one of the ones behind the Urals.
The real Russia.
Yeah, the real Russia. And there's a lot of history down back there. Like, that's where the Romanov family got killed. That's where they kind of moved all the factories to when they were pushing back from the front lines in World War II as Germany was advancing. There's a lot of that kind of history in Yekaterinburg. And to see the kids and be able to interact with them. There was another camp in there, I remember, that week, and to see how the coaches kind of dealt with their players, which is very, very different than here. And then also to see Pavel come in and interact with the kids. And he was having so much fun. Like, he would help with the drills for sure, but he was kind of also more on the sides, like just having fun with them. I can imagine those kids take those moments forever and ever. I remember being in the cafeteria one day having lunch with everybody was in there, and Pavel's just over like playing games with a few of the kids after they were done and everything like that. And he would play keep away with them. And he actually played keep away with one of the instructors. And I always remember it was so funny because the guy was trying so hard to take the puck off of him, and Pavel looking like he's not trying at all. And there was no chance he was getting the puck off of him. It was amazing. And to get to know him a little bit as well, I wrote a cover story on him for the Hockey News. I wrote daily files on the camp every day that I was there. It was just all around one heck of an experience, just for all those reasons, to see all those things, do all those things, get on the ice with them. And one of the kids, his name is Dennis Yan, actually got drafted into the NHL as a third rounder by Tampa Bay a couple of years ago.
Nice.
Yeah.
Certainly pull for that guy and keep an eye on him.
For sure.
We're still sort of in lockstep. Mother Russia comes in to play with my number one as well. Is there anyone you've been happier to see get their cup than Alex Ovechkin?
Ray Bourque, but not in the last decade. Yeah.
The winner of the Conn Smythe Trophy as the most valuable player in the playoffs, the leading goal scorer in the playoffs, and the captain of the Washington Capitals, Alex Ovechkin.
Predictable, and that will go nicely with the Stanley Cup and the Art Ross and the Hart and the Lindsay and the Calder and the Rocket Richards. He's already won.
Yeah, that was great.
I just thought the ship had sailed and he was just always going to have to hear the yeah, but. And that game six, when they eliminated Pittsburgh and slayed the Dragon, Kuznetsov in overtime. Mm-hmm. The way they came back against Tampa to win 6-7 and get to that final and then be, you know, teetering again to losing the first game and Braden Holtby on Alex Tuch in game two. And just the, joy, raging enthusiasm, over the top, probably slightly reckless behavior that occurred after, but just seeing how much it meant to Ovi and to know that he got one, and that organization too, really.
Yeah.
I just remember being so happy for that guy, because I just feel like the guys on that level shouldn't have to hear the yeah buts, you know? Yep. And I was just really, really happy for him.
Yeah. I mean, it's unfair to have that expectation thrust upon somebody in a 31 team league versus when it was six, right? It's so hard to accomplish. You're right. He was the one from the past decade that really moved the needle for me, and that felt really, really good for him as an individual to be able to lift that trophy. And next step, this is going to be for the next decade, is I want to see his face. I want to see his celebration when he scores the goal that passes Wayne Gretzky.
I know you will beat this drum forever, and you're not the only one. Maybe that will be number one on our list of the 2020s. We started this podcast, honorable mention, to the day we kicked it off in 2015. Hopefully we're still going in 2030. You never know, right?
Yeah, for sure. I hope so.
All right, let's keep it going strong here. If you want to follow Rory on Twitter in 2020 and beyond, find him at Rory Boylan. Check out all the stuff he's doing for sportsnet.ca. Myself, at Dixon on Sports. Let's have a great new happy year, everyone. Check back soon for more glass rattling hockey action on Tape to Tape.